From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Allen Ginsberg changed the sound of American poetry. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear how. We'll talk with Ginsberg about his new CD box set, which collects his recordings of his poems and songs from 1949 to 1993. Also today, Barbara Cook. Stephen Sondheim once described her as one of the two or three finest singers of song. She originated roles in The Music Man and Leonard Bernstein's Candide. Now she's one of Cabaret's greatest singers. And commentator Dagoberto Gilb reflects on the impossible task of impressing his teenage son. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Today's election will determine the new makeup of the House of Representatives. Republicans hope to pick up the 40 seats they need to take control of the chamber for the first time in 40 years. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
From the red clay fields of Georgia to the desert of eastern Washington, Republicans are framing this election as one of change and therefore making it a dangerous time to be a Democratic incumbent. House Speaker Tom Foley is the most famous, and there are many others whose re-election prospects are as grim, including Neil Smith in Iowa, Jack Brooks in Texas, and Dan Rostenkowski in Illinois. Several Democratic freshmen who won election 2 years ago on their own promises of change are in trouble. Some, including Eric Fingerhut of Ohio and Karen Shepard of Utah, are under attack for the failure of widely publicized efforts they led for campaign finance and lobby reform. Today's election may bring to Washington a large new crop of freshman reformers pushing for change. This time, most would be Republicans. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
California voters are choosing a governor and a U.S. senator today. NPR's Anna Jaffe has a preview of the election.
In the Senate race, incumbent Democrat Dianne Feinstein has faced stiff opposition from her Republican challenger, freshman Congressman Michael Huffington. He spent $27 million of his own money, making this the most expensive race in Senate history, and the money has enabled him to run months of negative ads attacking Feinstein as a career politician. Feinstein has touted her record in Washington, especially her authorship of the ban on assault weapons. Republican Governor Pete Wilson has run a disciplined campaign against his Democratic challenger, State Treasurer Kathleen Brown. He's focused on just two issues, crime and illegal immigration. His support for ballot initiative 187 is controversial, however. The measure would deny most health and education services to illegal immigrants, and support for it has been declining in recent weeks. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The United Nations Security Council has decided to set up an international tribunal to try people accused of genocide and other crimes in Rwanda. The council overrode objections by Rwanda. The vote was 13 in favor in the 15-nation council. Rwanda cast a negative vote. China abstained. Between 500,000 and 1 million people, mainly members of the Tutsi minority and Hutu opponents of the former Hutu-led government, are believed to have been massacred in Rwanda over the past 6 months. Authorities in Wycliffe, Ohio, say they don't know why a man opened fire with a rifle in a local middle school yesterday. Police allege that Keith Lediger went into Wycliffe Middle School yesterday and killed a custodian. Three other people were shot and wounded before Lediger was himself shot by a police officer. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 23 points at 3,832. This is NPR. The attorney for Susan Smith says he may ask that his client's trial be moved away from Union, South Carolina. Crowds jeered her last week when she was brought to the courthouse to face charges of murdering her two young sons. Sheriff Howard Wells says his office has gotten calls threatening Smith. Her attorney, David Bruck, says he's also thinking about using an insanity defense. Smith is now being held in isolation and under a 24-hour suicide watch. A new study finds that eating spinach and some other vegetables may help prevent a common form of blindness in the elderly. David Barron of member station WBUR prepared this report.
Many elderly people gradually lose the central part of their vision due to a condition called macular degeneration. The disorder is usually untreatable. But researchers at the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary suggest it may be preventable. The scientists have found that people who eat diets rich in green leafy vegetables, particularly spinach and collard greens, appear far less likely to develop the vision disorder than those who rarely eat the vegetables. The researchers, writing in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association, attribute the protective effect to nutrients called carotenoids. Carotenoids may protect the eye by blocking the damage caused by naturally occurring substances called free radicals. A second study in this week's journal finds carotenoids may also help prevent heart attacks. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
Greek authorities say all 77 people aboard an Olympic Airways flight are safe after a hijacking ended peacefully. Officials say the incident started over Germany when a man who claimed to have a bomb commandeered the flight. The plane landed in Salonika, Greece, where the passengers and crew were freed. Then an airport official reportedly persuaded the man to surrender. Officials say the man was unarmed and the hijacking might have been a prank. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix.
That's Allen Ginsberg giving his first complete reading of his now classic poem, Howl. This historic recording was made by a photographer in the audience at Berkeley's Town Hall Theater in 1956. It's included on a new box set called Holy Soul Jelly Roll, which collects Ginsberg's poems and songs as recorded between 1949 and 1993. Writing about the collection in the New York Times, critic Ken Tucker described it as an immensely enjoyable time capsule of the way poetry and pop culture have interacted for half a century. Allen Ginsberg changed the course of American poetry. He made poetry an essential part of beat culture, then hippie culture, and is now at the age of 68 a father figure to many performance poets. We invited him to talk with us about his new box set retrospective. Let's start with Howl, which was partly inspired by Ginsberg's mother, who had been in a mental hospital.
She had been there for several years, and I had put her there after a breakthrough of some very violent behavior toward her sister and a cousin she was staying with. And then I had gone out to San Francisco, but the grief was very much on my mind. I had a friend, Carl Seldman, with whom I had been in a mental hospital 6 years before, and he was back also in Pilgrim State, too. So I addressed the poem ostensibly to him, but the emotions were, I think, directed toward my mother, both grief and a sense of solidarity.
Yeah, you know, part one begins with one of your most famous lines.
Yeah.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness.
Starving, hysterical, naked. The original phrase was starving, mystical, naked, but I figured that was a little bit too simple-minded, because the problem was not all the problem of society. It was also the neurosis of the people. So there's a certain ironic edge to it, which I don't think critics at the time realized. I said starving, hysterical, naked. So it wasn't just a one-dimensional protest for the safety of madmen. It was also like trying to give a quick sketches of a series of cases that I drew from real life.
And what is part two, Moloch, about to you?
That kind of name, the Moloch attempts to name the social crisis and the illness of the society and the individual, pointing out that it's the desensitization caused by hyper-mechanization and hyper-industrialization, that people have become robots. Moloch is originally from the Bible, a false god to whom the tribes were sacrificing their children. The original idea is a sort of a devil goat with horns and seven furnaces, brass furnaces in the belly, and children would sacrifice their parents would sacrifice their children to Moloch as a sort of god of war. And in a sense, that was happening in America at that time. There was a buildup of the war machine, the beginnings of the crisis that led to the Indo-Chinese wars that wasted the nation, and I think caused the fall of America in the long run.
Let me play some of the Moloch section from Howl.
Moloch, whose fate is a cloud of sexless hydrogen. Moloch, whose name is a mime. Moloch in whom I sit lonely. Moloch in whom I dream angels. Crazy in Moloch. Sucker in Moloch. Black love and manless in Moloch. Moloch who entered my soul early. Moloch in whom I am a consciousness without a body. Moloch who burns down the love of the world. Moloch whom I abandon.
Your reading changes in this part of the poem. It sounds more like an incantation, and your voice changes too.
Yes, I think it gets to some sort of emotional giving out, opening up of emotion, both my own feeling of solitude, loneliness, disorientation, and at the same time a reliance on my own feelings as being real. So it's a sort of a realization of my own perceptions and feelings as not only being real, but probably shared by many other people.
Now, I want to move on to another poem, America, that was read the same night as Howl.
That's the very first unveiling of that poem. It's really funny. The text in the recording differs a little from the final text that I wound up with.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few extra, some very funny lines, actually.
Yeah, it really is very funny, and you get a lot of laughs from the audience.
Well, it sounds like a stand-up comedy routine. That's the era, actually, of Lenny Bruce around San Francisco. He was playing, I think, at the Purple Onion, and I went down to see him and watch his act, actually. But I hadn't expected that kind of reaction. And I didn't think the poem was that good, nor did Kerouac. It was just sort of like a joke, you know, like a takeoff, send-up of America, very lighthearted. But it's done with many different voices in a kind of schizophrenic persona. You know, 1 minute serious, 1 minute faggoty, 1 minute desperate, 1 minute religious, 1 minute patriotic, 1 minute I'm putting my queer shoulder to the wheel.
Why don't we hear the beginning of America as you read it in 1956 at Town Hall in Berkeley?
America, I've given you all and now I'm nothing. America, $2.27, January 17th, 1956. America, I can't stand my own mind. America, when will we end the human war? Go f*** yourself with your atom bomb. I don't feel good. Don't bother me. I won't write my poem until I'm in my right mind. When will you be angelic? When will you take off your clothes? When will you look at yourself through the grave? When will you be worthy of your million Christs? America, why are your libraries full of tears? America, when will you send your eggs to India? I'm sick of your insane demands. When will you reinvent the heart? When will you manufacture lambs? When will your cowboys reach Spangler? When will your dams release the flood of eastern tears? When will your technicians get drunk and abolish money? When will you institute religions of perception in your legislatures? When can I go into the supermarket and buy what I need with my good looks? America, after all, it is you and I who are perfect, not the next world. Your machinery is too much for me. I don't want to work for a living. You made me want to be a saint. There must be some other way to settle this argument.
Allen Ginsberg recorded in 1956. That's one of the recordings featured on his new box set, Holy Soul Jelly Roll. You know, you must have seen yourself as a provocateur in a way at a very young age. I'm thinking, you know, that you were just coming from a place that was not average. You know, your mother was mentally ill. Your mother had been a communist. You were gay. You were an intellectual. You loved poetry. I mean, about your life kind of set you apart.
But you got to realize, by this time, I had already known William Burroughs and Jack Kerouac 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
This is not, you know, some sudden discovery of a community or ideas. We had had a long period of privacy and silence to ripen our art, to know each other and to amuse each other and to understand each other's language and intelligence and sort of enlarge our own consciousness with the experience of others. Also, I'd already had some sort of natural religious experience, and we had all, by this time, tried out some of the psychedelic drugs in addition, on top of a natural religious experience that was without drugs, and already had traveled a bit. And so we were, I wasn't a young kid then, I was 28 years old. You know, it was quite a ripe time.
Was it surprising to you to find people like Burroughs and Kerouac who you felt this kind of friendship and aesthetic closeness with?
No, it was just some sort of natural kinship that we felt almost instantly on meeting.
But did you expect you'd ever find that?
Not exactly, but I hadn't even conceived of such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I conceived of friends, and I'd had friends in high school, but I was still in the closet. Kerouac was the first person I was able to come out of the closet to and tell him about it, and actually slept with him once or twice, though he was primarily straight. But he was very tender toward me, and he saw that I was in solitary and in a great deal of confusion and anguish, and he took a sort of kindly view. Burroughs was always brought out front and clear and lucid and intelligent, as he is now. At the age of 80, he was so. At the age of 34, I think he was then. So I was lucky when I was 17 that I met people whose genius sort of ignited my own talents to, and sort of upgraded, I think, my own natural intelligence. But I'm really a student of Kerouac and of Burroughs, and in some respects an imitator. I've had a steadier life, and so I'm perhaps more on the scene as now, on the air, or going around giving readings. But I feel myself basically a pupil of Kerouac's ear, and his intelligence and language, and his awareness of the pronunciation of consonants.
Well, when you talk about being a student of Kerouac's, I've never been able to tell how much your style of reading influenced him and how much his style of reading influenced you.
Oh, I think his style influenced me. It was way back in 47, 48, I heard him read Shakespeare aloud. And it was such an interesting intonation that he put into a soliloquy of Hamlet, I think, where Hamlet is sitting down on the steps saying, what am I, what am I doing? Am I nothing but a John of Dreams? And the way Kerouac said a John of Dreams, it was like his mind went off into a little dream at it in that phrase. So I began seeing that there were intonations, differences of pitch possible. You know, most poetry still is pronounced in a monotone or a duotone, it's like I'm talking now in a sort of monotone. But there are possibilities in conversation where you go from, you know, a little high woodle when you're talking to a little baby to down to very serious heart tones when you're talking to your grandmother and on her last days on earth.
Of course, with your readings, I always felt that there was a certain Hebraic intonation, even though I know that, you know, Buddhism was probably an even greater influence on you, and you certainly hear that in your voice, too, but there is that kind of Hebraic
The Hebraic
sound.
Thing is very real. Mm-hmm. My grandfathers were rabbis, and one of the most strong musical influence I ever had was the hearing of a recording of Sophie Breslau, a great operatic singer, singing Eli Eli, with a kind of melismus, I guess you'd call it, sort of a very beautiful way of bending the notes that's characteristic of Hebrew melody.
Now, when did that start to enter your reading style?
Well, certainly with Kaddish, because I was imitating the davening motion of Kaddish with the sound of Yishgadal, Yishgadas, Yishaleh, Yishalol, Made Kushu, Bukhu. Da-da-da, 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 magnificent, mourn no more, martyr of heart, mind behind, married dream, mortal changed.
Hmm.
That is the whole rhythm of the poem has a kind of combination of Ray Charles, I Got a Woman, Yes Indeed, Yes Indeed, Yes Indeed, and which I'd been hearing the morning before I wrote the poem, and a rhythm of the original Hebrew Kaddish that was still running through my mind and body. For the first time I'd heard it, actually. A Jewish friend played it to me in dawnlight the morning that I started writing the poem.
And the Kaddish is the Hebrew prayer for the dead.
Yes, it's a kind of a mass or a prayer for the dead done in the synagogue when you have a minyan or a group of elders that can get together to help you mourn for the dead.
So I guess you didn't say the prayer when your mother died.
Well, I didn't know it as well, but I did try and do it. Actually, I wandered around San Francisco with Jack Kerouac and Philip Whalen, and we went into various synagogues, but there was no minyan, so that we couldn't do it. So this is a way of making up about a couple years later.
And this is a couple of years after your mother, Naomi,
yeah, my mother died.
In
55. Incidentally, you know, I sent her the original, a copy of the original manuscript of Howl, which she received about a week before she died, and she wrote me a letter which was postmarked the day she died, which is quoted in Kaddish, in which she said she got my poems. She can't tell whether it's good or bad. My father should judge because he's a poet, but judging from the, but I should, she'd read it up. She said, well, get married, Alan, don't take drugs. And she said, I have the key. The key is in the window. The key is in the sunlight in the window. And then she died of stroke, I think, perhaps hours or within 24 hours of writing the letter. So I received that letter after I had heard that she died.
Huh.
So it was like a message from the land of the dead, so to speak.
My guest is Allen Ginsberg. He has a new CD box set called Holy Soul Jelly Roll, featuring recordings of his poems and songs from 1949 to 1993. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with poet Allen Ginsberg. Now, if you had grandfathers who were rabbis, did you say?
Well, scholars, you know, long guys with big black hats and long bearded, long gray beards, who died of cancer from smoking, actually,
in New York
in the 30s.
How did you get to be in your 20s before you heard the prayer for the dead?
Well, we didn't. My mother was communist and my father was socialist.
So you didn't go to a synagogue?
So I did go to synagogue, and I went to Sunday school, or what do you call it, the shul, to learn Hebrew and traditional, prepare for a bar mitzvah, but somehow I asked questions that were resented by the rabbi, and I got kicked out when I was about 8 years old or nine. And I never did understand it, because I thought I was just sort of talking intelligently to him and inquiring. That there must have been an edge of skepticism to it, but there was no tolerance for that at all. Mm. My questions weren't answered, and I was just told to get out. So I've never had very much of a classical Hebrew education.
Your mother was institutionalized several times.
Many, many times, all during my childhood. I had to go out to visit her in Greystone Hospital.
Were you frightened by her madness?
Sometimes sorrowed, sometimes frightened, sometimes stuck with a responsibility I couldn't carry out as a kid, going out alone to see her in a mental hospital when I was 12, 13, 14. Or having to stay home and take care of her while my father was in school teaching, and getting into crisis situations with her that I couldn't handle, actually. It kind of broke my brain, in a way, broke my spirit to some extent.
No, when you started doing hallucinogenics, like LSD, did your hallucinations ever scare you because you'd seen your mother have hallucinations and delusions because of her mental illness?
Well, no, not really. I realized that if everybody began disagreeing with me, I better look around twice and think three times and be pretty sure I knew what I was doing. And so I've been able to be in situations where everybody disagreed, but at the same time maintain my sanity, so to speak, by simply following my heart, really. I have as much a tendency to paranoia as anybody in the United States at this point, but at least I can see it's paranoia, and most people don't see their own paranoia.
That's interesting. So your mother's delusions actually helped you figure out what was real and what wasn't?
Well, I went through the, I sort of went through the mill already, so I was kind of inoculated. I would say that the experience of having to deal with somebody who was sort of deluded and hallucinating, also voices and all, helped me deal with my own psychic disturbances and also with the psychic disturbances of other people. I seem to have a kind of tolerance that, you know, in one ear, out the other, or, you know, like, so that I can be with people who are quite disturbed, get disturbed myself, but not so much so that I have to turn my back until, you know, all hope is lost.
Where were you in your performance style in 1964, the year that the recording of Kaddish was made?
I hadn't ever tried to read anything as long as Kaddish, complete. And so there, and I had drunk a little bit, not very much, so I wasn't really drunk, but I was sort of a little keyed up with alcohol so that I was able to loosen my feelings quite a bit. So the only problem there is maintaining control of feelings and not breaking up and crying in the middle of the more moving passages.
Is there a particular section of Kaddish that you've had the most problem with controlling your emotion?
Yeah, there's the section that begins when I'm visiting my mother in the mental hospital for the last time, and I walk in and I see she's had a stroke, and then there suddenly is a break in the poem, and there's a kind of lyrical rhapsody. Come in as beauty, sit here married in the summer among daisies, promised happiness at hand. To a section that ends, oh, beautiful garbo of my karma. It's really a nice, exquisite, poetic passage, but it's also full of feeling, and it's like a flashback in the midst of tragedy to a happier day. And so there's a lot of emotion buried there from childhood. Also, at the very end, the section, oh, mother, what have I left out? Oh, mother, what have I forgotten? With your eyes, with your death full of flowers. That has a sort of cumulative emotional buildup that's quite great.
Why don't I play an excerpt of Kaddish? And you wrote this in the late 1950s. The recording we're going to hear from your new box set was made at Brandeis University in 1964.
With your eyes running naked out of the apartment, screaming into the hall, with your eyes being led away by policemen to an ambulance, with your eyes strapped down on an operating table, with your eyes with a pancreas removed, with your eyes of appendix operation, with your eyes of abortion, with your eyes of ovaries removed, with your eyes of shock, with your eyes of lobotomy, with your eyes of divorce, with your eyes of stroke, with your eyes alone, with your eyes, with your eyes, with your death full of flowers.
That's Allen Ginsberg reading an excerpt of Kaddish. It's included on his new box set, Holy Soul, Jelly Roll. Tell us just a little bit about what your life is like now.
Well, I have a little heart trouble and diabetes, but I travel a bit still, and I write quite a bit, and I'm doing a lot of photography and put out several books of photos. And so this year I think I'll do some doodles and have them sort of start drawing. So, you know, just enjoying myself at the age of 68, extending my activities in various directions, but focused primarily on writing and on poetry, with the idea that candor ends paranoia. If I can make my own mind transparent so that people know what I'm really thinking, they don't have anything to be scared of, and they can use it as a mirror for their own minds.
Allen Ginsberg, his new CD box set, Holy Soul Jelly Roll, is on Rhino Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Hey, Father Death, I'm flying home. Hey, poor man, you're all alone. Hey, old daddy, I know where I'm going. Father Death, don't cry anymore. Mama's there underneath the floor. Brother
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Barbara Cook used to be known as one of Broadway's ingenues. She was the Music Man's original Marion the Librarian and originated a role in She Loves Me. Now in her 60s, she's been called the High Priestess of Cabaret. Coming up, we talk with Barbara Cook and hear music from her latest CD, Live in London. Also, A Father's Lament. Commentator Dagoberto Gilb says he's impressed the critics and the award givers, but he's yet to impress his teenage son. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Republicans are hoping for big gains tonight. Texas Senator Phil Graham is predicting the GOP will pick up about 11 U.S. Senate seats. That's four more than they need to control the Senate. Graham chairs the Senate Republican Campaign Committee. He's told CBS Republican candidates will defeat Democratic incumbents in New Jersey, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee. He also predicts his party will win open seats in Maine, Ohio, Michigan, Oklahoma, Arizona, and Tennessee. Those seats were held by Democrats who are retiring. The Republicans need 40 Democratic House seats to take control of the House of Representatives. Texas Governor Ann Richards and her Republican challenger George W. Bush are working in some last-minute campaigning. Lisa Garvin of member station KUHF reports from Houston.
The race between Democratic incumbent Ann Richards and Republican challenger George W. Bush is expected to be so close it will be a late night counting ballots. 15% of the state's 8.6 million voters cast early ballots, and today's turnout is expected to be quite high. University of Houston political analyst Dr. Richard Murray doesn't even want to speculate on the outcome.
The governor needs at least decent voting today in Hispanic and black precincts. George W. Bush figures to be very strong with white suburban voters. So probably a late-night call on that one.
Murray says a surge of Republican voters at the polls will be a thorn in Richard's side, and she'll be working the phone banks later today in a last effort to lure disillusioned Democrats back to the polls. For National Public Radio, I'm Lisa Garvin in Houston.
New Jersey voters are deciding the outcome of a close Senate contest. It pits the 12-year incumbent against the Republican State Assembly Speaker. Gene Dillard reports from Trenton the race has been mostly negative.
Democratic Senator Frank Lautenberg has sought to portray his challenger, Republican Chuck Haitian, as an extremist, out of step with the views of most New Jerseyans. He stressed Haitian's role in trying to repeal the state's assault weapons ban, his anti-abortion views, and his association with a controversial New York City talk show host who many believe to be a racist. Haitian, for his part, has painted Lautenberg as a tax-and-spend Democrat, and he's endorsed a flat-rate federal income tax. However, Rutgers political science professor Cliff Zukin says that message hasn't caught on.
You could say that the flat tax has fallen flat as a message that resonates with voters.
Lautenberg has maintained a lead throughout the campaign, but analysts believe Haitian can still win if he can capture the large number of voters who are still undecided. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
The Postal Service hopes to raise the price of a first-class stamp to 32 cents in January. The Postal Board chairman says consumers should be prepared. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow rose more than 21 points to end the day at 3,830. This is NPR News. Los Angeles prosecutors say they won't charge Al Cowlings with helping O.J. Simpson flee during the broadcast Slow Speed Highway Chase. They say they don't have enough evidence. District Attorney Gil Garcetti says he can't prove a case. He had threatened to file felony charges against anyone who helped Simpson try to flee. There'd been some confusion yesterday over whether the Cowlings investigation had been completed or not. Cowlings' lawyer says his client is very happy the investigation is behind him. The World Bank has approved a $110 million loan to clean up Russian environmental problems like the massive Siberian oil spill. NPR's Philip Davis reports.
The idea is to reverse 70 years of what the bank calls Russia's fragmented and uncoordinated environmental management. In the communists' rush to industrialize, they ignored environmental protection. As a result, Russian factories alone are responsible for more acid rain now than Britain, France, and Germany combined. Millions of acres of Russian land have been eroded, clear-cut, strip-mined, and abandoned. The $110 million loan, the bank hopes, will be augmented with an additional $80 million from Russian banks and companies, as well as additional funds from Western countries, for a total of $280 million. Though the money can be used for a variety of projects, Russian officials have indicated that one priority would be the cleanup of a massive oil spill now fouling the delicate Siberian ecosystem. In Washington, I'm Philip Davis reporting.
NASA officials say ozone monitors aboard the Space Shuttle Atlantis confirm the Earth's ozone layer has a hole in it. NASA says the monitors show there's very little of the critical gas inside the ozone hole above Antarctica. The ozone layer is crucial. It protects the Earth from the sun's ultraviolet rays. Meanwhile, the astronauts are testing freon-filled aluminum pipes aboard the shuttle. It's hoped the test will make it easier to cool future spaceships. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Barbara Cook has been called a high priestess of cabaret and one of Broadway's most beloved lyric sopranos. On Broadway, she originated the role of Marion the Librarian in The Music Man and co-starred in the original production of She Loves Me, which was recently revived on Broadway. She also starred in Leonard Bernstein's Candide. Her concert career has taken her around the world. When I spoke with her last year, she had a new CD called Closest Pages in a Book, featuring the lyrics of Dorothy Fields.
We'll be closest pages in a book, my love and I. So close, we can share a single look, share. That before I hear your laugh, my laugh breaks through. And when a tear starts to appear, my eyes grow misty too.
I asked Barbara Cook about her early Broadway career. She had sung before Broadway, but she made her acting debut in her first Broadway musical, Flahoolie.
When I first started doing them, I had never acted. And when I got Flahoolie, I was just floored because, you know, I really hadn't been here long trying to do this. And I got a leading role, Jerome Cortland. And I played the juvenile and ingenue roles is what you would say now. And the thing is, though, we didn't have secondary roles. They were the primary roles, so that the storyline hung on our storyline. So we had a lot of responsibility as far as the show goes, and I was very nervous about it. I was convinced all the time that I was going to be replaced by somebody in the chorus any minute. You know, so I was quite nervous. I'm a nervous person. Listen, I'm just finally beginning to settle down a little bit in my old age.
how has nervousness affected you over the years?
I don't know. I guess I just went ahead and did it anyway. I'm surprised sometimes when I think about it how I was surely one of the most nerve-wracked people you've ever known.
Well, what were the symptoms?
Oh, well, my hands would perspire so much that, perspiration would just drip off the palms of my hands. Honest to God, I'm amazed. And I was just always so nervous about how people going to like this or think about that. And it took me a long time to settle that. I don't know. And yet, at the same time, I always had a lot of confidence in my singing. So there's that dichotomy there that I don't completely understand. For instance, in Flahoolie, as I say, I was sure I was going to be replaced any minute, and I developed all kinds of nervous ailments that I'd never had before. And I remember we were in Philadelphia trying out the show, and I remember coming in one evening, saying to myself, if this is what it's like to do musical comedy, I've got to try to find something else to do. I can't stand this. I can't take this. And at the same time, I remember hearing an orchestration for the first time for one of my songs. And I wasn't able to phrase a particular line in the same way that I had in rehearsal and the way that I wanted to do it. And so the conductor, Maurice Levine, said, Barbara, you know, you're going to have to do this a little differently. And I said, but Maurice, you know, that doesn't work that way. Change the orchestration. And he said, Barbara, we can't change the orchestration. It's expensive and other than. And I said, well, Maurice, you know, they hired me to do what I do. And I can't do what I do with this orchestration like this. So they changed it. But when I think back, that doesn't sound like somebody who's very scared, does it?
No, it sounds like someone who has chutzpah.
Yeah, doesn't it? So, I don't know, those two things existed side by side.
So you had confidence in your singing, but maybe not so much confidence in either you as a human being or something.
You got it. Right there, you said it.
In your early days on Broadway, you had the image of the ingenue. Now, what exactly does that mean?
Well, I don't know. A lot of the roles I played were not really ingenue roles. I just think I looked so much like an ingenue that people thought of me as the quintessential ingenue for years. Certainly, for instance, when I did Oklahoma, I didn't play Laurie, which is, well, even Laurie is not really so much of an ingenue. She's a very spunky lady. But I played Ada Wanny. I played the comedy role. And the first time I did Carousel, I played Carrie. I didn't play Julie. It was only later on that I played Julie, who's really like a leading lady. So then when I did Candide, Cunegonde is like a cartoon of ingenues. She's a cartoon. And she finally, at the end of the show, she's a very old lady with a hump on her back. And, you know, it's yet I've been tagged with this ingenue thing. Isn't that funny?
So did that affect the image that you thought you were supposed to have?
I think maybe it did. I guess it did. I don't know how. I didn't think about that so much until you just said it.
One change that I know happened in your life, and this was a physical change, is that there was a period, I'm not sure how old you were, when you ended up putting on a lot of weight. And I imagine that changed the kind of roles you could get even.
Well, yeah, sure, absolutely. For a while I thought that my memory of that time was that I wasn't being sent things to do, you know, sent scripts, I mean. But that's not true. I was being sent scripts. I just didn't want to work, I think. I think it was that period when I was sort of shifting over from playing all these kind of youthful roles, and I didn't know quite where to aim myself, do you know? It was an awkward time. I think I would have felt guilty if I just said to myself, well, I'm just going to take a few years off here. And so I think that's maybe one reason why I started gaining weight. I don't know. It sort of gave me an excuse to not work. I have no idea. Listen, if I knew, I'd tell you.
Right.
Boy, I don't have a clue.
Right. So what effect did it have on your work as an actress and as a singer?
Well, it kept me from working, I think, for a while there. And then what happened is in, 1973, I did a long tour all through the summer and into the fall. It was a concert of all Gershwin material. It was the 75th anniversary of Gershwin's birth. And it was sort of a big year celebrating Gershwin that year. And that was the first time in a long time that I had sung as myself, if you will, rather than singing as a character. And I loved doing it. And I remember saying to one of the agents involved, gosh, I really would like to do some cabaret. And he said, but Barbara, there's no place to play. And within a year, cabaret had a kind of renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time 74 rolled around, Wally Harper and I decided to get together and see what we could come up with. And then the middle of 74, we went into a little place called Brothers and Sisters. And we had been asked to come in for a couple of weeks, and then we stayed the whole summer. So we were there for about 7 weeks. And then, believe it or not, the next stop was Carnegie Hall. Carnegie Hall with a live album being done. Because what had happened was when we were at Brothers and Sisters, Herbert Breslin, who is the manager for Pavarotti, had heard us and had decided to do this concert.
Singer Barbara Cook is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with singer Barbara Cook. I know you've said that two of your great influences musically were Judy Garland and Mabel Mercer. And what interested me about that is that they're really opposites as performers. You know, Judy Garland was very emotional. There was always this tragic aura about her on stage. Whereas Mabel Mercer was very regal. She sang everything as an art song and sang with a certain amount of emotional distance in a way. You never felt she was necessarily singing about herself.
That's interesting.
And she was just so regal on stage. And I'm wondering what in terms of stage presence, if you felt you took things from each of them.
Well, when Judy was here at the Palace, there's a little after-hours club. It used to be called the Little Club. It was called the Gold Key Club. And it was a private club. You had to have this little gold key if you were a member to get in. And I knew the man who played piano there. Very often she would come over after her performance and sing some more for herself and for her friends. And so when she was going to be there, he would call me and I would come in so I could hear her do this stuff just for herself. And having a chance to observe her so close, I really learned a lot I never had any coaching per se. My voice teacher mainly was interested in technique, but I haven't had a lot of help with how do you sell a song or put it over, if you know what I mean. What I think I learned from Garland during those months was to think about shaping a song so that it had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and so that it had a kind of emotional line, do you know? Not necessarily the musical line, because I think I learned that working on Candide more, but that it had an emotional line. And that was something that hadn't occurred to me before. And with Mabel, she had this very idiosyncratic way of using words that could be so effective. That and also her take on a lyric was so personal. I'd never heard anybody have that kind of personal take on a lyric. Do you know what I mean by that? Her sense of irony was so strong, and I think actually her sense of humor in a song was greater than anybody I've ever heard. She broke so many rules. She sang consonants, you know, and you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to sing vowels and get off the consonants.
Now, explain what you mean by that.
Well, for instance, a word like wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we would be told to hold that wah, you know, to hold that, because that's how you get the sound out, and to get off that next N and D as fast as you can, wonderful. But, or to sing wonderful, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
But she would do things like wonderful.
Yes.
And it's more wonderful. So I learned that kind of thing from her.
Gee, you know, you're absolutely right. I never noticed that.
And a song like Remind Me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were just going to sing that straight, you might sing, Remind me not to find you so attractive. Remind me that the world is full of men. But she would sing, Remind me not to find you so attractive. Remind me. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, you got to be judicious with that stuff. But boy, she sure as hell knew how to do it, I'm telling you.
Well, that probably gave you permission to do things, too,
yeah,
that you discovered on your own.
Sure. I think so.
Do you think your voice has gone through different periods as you've gotten older?
Well, most voices do change timbre. They get darker.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I don't have those light, light, high notes like I did during the Candide days. But, I have other stuff. I have a much greater ability to put emotion into a song, much greater ability than I had in those years. It's amazing. When I used to do those cast albums, the albums were done the second Sunday after we opened, or the third Sunday soon after we opened. And I found that as I played the show, I found more and more things, and I liked the performances better, say, after 3-4 months, What used to happen is in the show albums, I was feeling so much, and I was getting maybe 1/8 of that into the voice,
How do you find a way to get that in?
Well, I guess it's just confidence in doing it.
It must be really good to like how your voice is changing and feel, more expression going into it. And...
Well, yeah, I do. Of course, I'd like to be able to do everything. I want to still be able to sing Q over X up there, but I can't do that anymore. But it's okay, because I got other stuff that I really like better if I had to choose.
Barbara Cook recorded last year. She has a new CD called Live from London. From it, let's hear I See Your Face Before Me.
I see your face before me, crowding my every dream. There is your face before me. You are my only theme. It doesn't matter where you are, I can see how fair you are. I close my eyes and there you are, always. If you could share.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what All Things Considered has planned for election night. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what kind of coverage are you looking at?
We're looking at very serious coverage of both the Senate and the House, Terry, because we are looking at the possibility that Republicans will do very well in the Senate and may even be doing almost that well in the House. So we'll be watching that. We'll be talking to voters on why they did what they did. We'll talk about a crime study, which indicates that although it's a big issue in this election, crime statistics are actually falling. This is the 5th anniversary of the fall of the wall in Berlin, and we'll look at what some East German politicians are doing now.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. After writing for over a decade, Dagoberto Gilb has finally been able to quit his day job as a carpenter and construction worker. His first book, a collection of stories called The Magic of Blood, was published last year. It won the Penn Hemingway Foundation Award for First Fiction and was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. Gilb was also a winner of the Whiting Writers Award. He's just published his first novel, The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuna. Gilb may have achieved recognition as a writer in the outside world, but there's still someone close to him that needs convincing.
Imagine this. One day you're pronounced a writer. I'm not talking about a book being published, even after all those years and years of waiting for that. But when they Say you've won an award for it and they fly you above the Chihuahua Desert, across all of Texas and over the Mississippi River, and then above all these roads and highways you've never driven on, never seen a single billboard sign from an airplane window, to a city as expensive sounding as Boston, Massachusetts. And they're paying. You've decided to take your son, who's 15. 15, those jerk years. The years when you can often look at him, once a soft, sweet baby, as tender as your first true love, and you are faced with the age-old fatherly question, does he want me to kick his ass? Is it right to kick his ass? Despite internal and external protestations to the contrary, would it be good to kick his ass? But you're taking him because you've always promised yourself that this day would come. You imagined that you and him, just the two of you, would go hiking up Glacier National Monument, that sacred Indian place of emerald lakes beneath pearl mountains of ice, risking the hazards of sudden snowdrifts and grizzly bears. But instead, Boston, as a writer. That's official language, upheld by a panel of wise judges, whether they'll regret it or not. You take your son because that right moment has come. Father and son, dad and boy, pops y mijo. The two of you together. And he's going to see this you, the writer you. That you you were those years he pointed to his empty mouth and bare feet and wondered why you weren't really working right then. It's like a rite of passage thing for him to go with you to Boston. Here's the secret part, the worm at the bottom of the bottle. Your son says, he says often, very often, so often it doesn't sound as funny as it does when you say it just once or twice or so. He says, books suck. Try meditating on that for a day and you'll get the impact. I mean this. For one full day, every time you see or hear about a book, you utter it. Whenever you think of a book, think, books suck. Imagine how it is if you write books, and that voice is your son's, your first son's, the cute baby all grown up, and you don't think he's kidding. And so when you get to Boston, you decide to sneak over to Annie, the Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award winner, who you admire so much, and warn her beforehand. You don't know her well, so you're a little worried about impressions. Annie, you whisper, I want to tell you so that it doesn't come as too much of a shock. My boy, my handsome son over there, if he happens to say, books suck, well, you know, please, forgive me, forgive him. How old is he, she asks, and she nods her head when you tell her. She says she understands. She has two sons. But do you believe her? No, hombre. You think she probably had sons who liked her for being a writer. She doesn't realize that your boy means it, that he really means it. So one day your son comes home from the mall with a friend. They saw a movie, and guess what? He bought a book. A book? You are a little suspicious. It's called This Book Sucks, a magnum opus featuring Beavis and Butthead. How do you like that, Dad? He asks, and he's smiling sarcastically, proud, like he wrote it. You look at the price. $12? He spent $12 on this book? Of his hard-earned money? Money he soaked from you, now that you think about it. So what do you think, Dad? It's a tough call, a real tough call. You ask him if he'll let you read it. Sure, he says, for the moment actually pleased with you.
Commentator Dagoberto Gilb lives in El Paso. His new novel, The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuña, is published by Grove Press. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an election post-mortem and a behind-the-scenes look at the Clinton administration. We talk with journalist Elizabeth Drew, author of the new book Over the Edge, The Clinton Presidency. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.